WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In summing up William F. Buckley's contributions to conservative politics in America, columnist George Will wrote, "Before there was Ronald Reagan, there was Barry Goldwater. And before there was Barry Goldwater, there was National Review. And before there was National Review, there was Bill Buckley." In a biography of Buckley, John Judas wrote, "It is impossible to understand American politics today without understanding the rise of American conservatism, and it is impossible to understand American conservatism without understanding Bill Buckley's extraordinary life." Buckley is the founder and editor-in-chief of the conservative magazine National Review, and for 23 years he's hosted the TV program Firing Line. His new book, On the Firing Line, combines his reflections on more than two decades of broadcasts with transcribed excerpts of some of its most spirited exchanges. Buckley started the show in 1966 during a period he describes as the kid years.
I call it the kid years because the 1966 always evokes a period characterized primarily by the licentiousness of youth, whether they are going to Woodstock leaving the detritus of 700,000 people, whoever it was, or whether they're busting up political conventions, or whether they're throwing deans in the Charles River in Cambridge. They dominated the epoch. There was a sense of anarchy during the 60s. Its tributaries are diverse, everything from Vietnam to whatever. But I think the kid years is as neat and facile a designation as you can come up with.
This was good for you, right? It gave you a lot of targets to work with.
Yeah, there were an awful lot of programs on Firing Line that were devoted to one or another aspect of that kind of thing. One has to remember, those of us parochial enough to think that it was uniquely an American phenomenon, that in 1968 there were riots in Mexico, Rome, Paris, where de Gaulle was almost overthrown, London, Chile. So that there was some fever that was almost endemic in the globe. It was halfway through the Cultural Revolution in China. So it was a very, very turbulent period.
In your book about hosting Firing Line, you talk about the manifest evasiveness of many of the people who have been on your program. What are your techniques for dealing with that?
Well, the first thing, of course, to do is to spot it. As you probably know, there are formal rhetorical techniques by which one avoids answering questions. Probably the generic evasion goes under the Latin title ignoratio elenchi, that is to say, pay no attention to the counterargument, so that, for instance, if I accuse you of not having done anything to stand in the way of a particular riot on Tuesday morning, you will perhaps give me a lecture in which you denounce riots, so that you give the audience the satisfaction of denouncing riots, but not me the satisfaction of asking why you didn't do anything about the riot on Tuesday. That would be an example. What I do is take 8 or 10 distinguished people, Norman Mailer, John Kenneth Galbraith, and a few others, and show how they use these various techniques. By the way, I give several examples of how I engage in it myself.
Do you think you're very good at manifest evasiveness yourself?
No, I tend not to be, for this reason, and that is that since I'm not a politician. I almost search out difficulties. If I were a politician, my primary concern would be self-defense. And self-defense simply requires you to ignore answering a question to which the only answer you could give would be embarrassing. But since I'm not that, I almost look for difficulties in my own position and tend to relish them.
In the 1960s and 70s, there was a period when no impressionist, no comic impressionist, could get off the stage without doing their impression of you. Who were among your favorites in terms of the impressions that they did of you?
I only heard one. I'm trying to think of his name.
You don't watch enough TV, do you?
excuse me? Well, I don't watch an awful lot of it, but this one was terribly funny. In fact, I retained him to show off at a National Review function where he did Kissinger and Nixon and a few other people who were present. His first name was David, and I'm embarrassed. I can't remember his last name. I know that Robin Williams does it, but I've never heard it. And Johnny Carson's done it in my presence, as well as when I wasn't there.
Was it David Fry?
David Fry, exactly. Thank you ever so much. And he's terribly funny.
When you see somebody doing an impression of you, like David Fry, does it make you self-conscious? Do you feel like you've ever changed anything in the way you sit or hold yourself on TV because of an impression that you saw?
No, because a successful impressionist is primarily a characterist. If I were, for instance, able to speak exactly like, say, Harold Macmillan, and I spoke and said exactly what Harold Macmillan said, people wouldn't think of me as an impressionist. They would think that it was Harold Macmillan talking. So therefore, a successful characterist is someone who not only imitates your voice, but hugely exaggerates the idiosyncratic way in which you speak. So that, for instance, anybody imitating Henry Kissinger would not merely say, read a paragraph from a Henry Kissinger book or article. He would get into thoughts of a kind that made amusing or distorted his common conversations.
William F. Buckley is my guest, and he's written a new book called On the Firing Line that includes excerpted transcripts of his 23 years of the Firing Line program.
Well, it includes, but is by no means restricted to.
No, absolutely, yes, and I didn't mean to imply that.
Right.
I know your father was a multimillionaire who made his fortune in oil. You went to private schools in England and France when you were growing up. Did you ever regret being that set apart from other Americans during your formative years?
It's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of myself as being set apart. I suppose somewhere along the line, when you're 9, 10, or 11 years old, you recognize that you're traveling first class. But there wasn't ever any sense of alienation. I had a very large family, and large families tend to be egalitarian in their impact. It's almost impossible to have an affectation when you have 9 brothers and sisters, as I had. So that I didn't feel that alienation. Besides which, if you pick up your knowledge from reading, as I think most of us do, and you do read, it's inconceivable that you should not know about Dickensian life in the 19th century or the life of the slums in the 20th century here and in Manila. The Gibbon knew an awful lot about the Roman Empire without ever having experienced it. So I'm always a little bit taken aback at the notion that because one has gone to private schools or to private colleges, one is AO ipso ignorant of other conditions.
There are a couple of stories which I suppose are true about how when you were 8, you wrote to the King of England demanding that England repay its war debt. And when you were 15, just during the first week at a new school, you wrote The Headmaster with your critique of the school. Assuming those stories are true, where did you get the chutzpah to do that?
Well, mostly ignorance. Certainly in the first case. In the second case, the second story is largely apocryphal.
The one about the headmaster, writing the headmaster.
Yeah. I've always expressed myself fairly freely, but with some sense of decorum. I don't interrupt the parade to lecture the bandmaster, which is a misimpression that people cultivate because it's kind of fun.
When you were growing up, did you have a sense of your father grooming you to become a certain kind of man or to take a certain place in society?
Yes, I did. My father groomed or tried to groom all of his children to be intellectually honest and morally responsible. Having said that, I should say that he's failed spectacularly because I don't consider myself as having lived up to the very high standards that he set.
You went to Yale, and I think right after getting out of Yale, though perhaps you started writing this when you were in Yale, you wrote the book, the bestseller God and Men at Yale, in which you critiqued liberal education. Would you give us a very brief synopsis of your critique? I realize this is difficult to ask, but...
Well, my critique was based on the assumption that the purpose of education is to make discoveries, however tentative. If you discover, to take a simple proposition, that 2 plus 2 equals 4, you have to be very, very firm in dealing with people who say that 2 plus 2 equals 5. Now, transporting a simple mathematical proposition on over to other moral propositions, I maintain that the purpose of education, among other things, is to cultivate values which you think are correct. And that under the circumstances, to take, say, Das Kapital and the Declaration of Independence and say, as between the two, I decline to commit myself as to which of the two represents the values we seek to further, is an act of nihilism. Academic freedom, to the extent that it does that, is nihilistic. It says we cannot ever know. The formulation of John Stuart Mill, you will remember, was that as long as one person doubts a proposition, that proposition cannot be held to be true. I think that's utter and total frivolous nonsense.
Did you feel that Yale had failed you personally as a student?
No. I failed Yale as a student because Yale and any university in the country is going to offer you more than you can possibly take from it, in the sense that it has such extraordinary variety. My brief against Yale was that it was not living up to its own charter. Its own charter was pretty explicit on its purpose, but the doctrine of academic freedom, as it reigned in those days and continues to reign today, simply says, in effect, nothing is knowable. And under the circumstances, all points of view are tentative, and it is a hubristic act to assume that any one point of view is better than any other. They use the metaphor starting equal in the race. Now, the paradoxes at Yale were that it was heavily oriented in favor of collectivism in its economic courses, with one or two exceptions, and heavily anti-Christian, with one or two exceptions, in its philosophical courses. Given the fact that the patrimony of Yale was Christian and also individualistic, believers in the market, that seemed to me a running act of hypocrisy that Yale needed to contend with.
After you graduated from Yale, you briefly joined the CIA as a covert agent. You were sent, I believe, to Mexico. Was this the fulfillment of a fantasy in any way?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, you later wrote spy fiction, so I wasn't sure. Why did you want to join the CIA?
Well, I wanted to join the CIA because I had been in the infantry in the Second World War, and a professor who was also partly a mentor of mine at Yale turned out to himself to have attenuated but nevertheless genuine connections with the CIA. And it was his informal job to try to recruit talent. As you know, there was a lot of recruitment in 1950 for the CIA. I don't know the round numbers, but he said to me in effect, look, the Korean War is going to heat up. You plan to get married next month, which I did plan to do and did do. Would you prefer to go back into the infantry or do something a little bit more interesting? That was a very easy choice.
So you were stationed in Mexico?
Yeah.
What was your mission?
Oh, I can't tell you what my mission was. But my cover was that I was there to look after some investments of my father, who had lived there for 20 years.
Why did you quit? You only stayed 9 months.
I got bored, and I had published my first book, and various people were offering me jobs, so I signed up to work as an associate editor of the American Mercury, back before it cooked.
Do you think you could have been a good agent? Did you have a talent for the kind of work?
I don't think so. An agent has, above all, to be extremely patient. And patience is not my specialty. 98% of the work of CIA agents is equivalent to walking the beat. As somebody pointed out, we spend perhaps $1 billion a year collecting material that the Soviet Union can collect by simply going down to a magazine store at Grand Central. All of that requires very, very careful reading, very, very careful note-taking. So there's an awful lot of sheer tedium in CIA. That's not the kind of thing we read about in my novels so much, though I do make it a point to remark that phenomenon, or see in the movies, because you're always showing people shooting at each other and jumping off towering infernos. That aspect of the CIA life is probably 1/1,000,000 of 1%.
Is it fair to say that in the late 50s and in the early 60s, you saw it as your mission to take the right out of the hands of John Birchers and Klansmen and the lunatic fringe?
To the extent that it is correct to say that the right was their property, for instance, the John Birch Society wasn't founded until 1959, so it was hardly in the hands of the Birchers in 1958. But what I felt was my responsibility to do was to do something to revitalize the right. The right was generally thought of as an aggregation of rich people who sat around in rooms and puffing their cigars, deciding how best they could exploit other people for the benefit of a privileged few. This wasn't my idea at all of what the vibrant conservative movement had done to create the most prosperous country in the world. So the answer is yes, that was my feeling of about what needed to be done.
What was wrong with the Republican establishment?
Well, it was strangely unvocal. There wasn't a single magazine that was both conservative and intellectual. There wasn't a journal of opinion. The Freeman wasn't that because it was a property of a foundation. The American Mercury was eccentric.
That's a magazine.
And fell into the hands of anti-Semites mm-hmm. in 1952. Mm-hmm. So when we came around, there wasn't really another guy on the street, with the exception of Human Events, which was primarily Washington-oriented. So National Review began that whole, rather revived that whole movement.
Mm-hmm. National Review is the magazine that you started.
Yeah.
Now, it seems in a way that some of your positions were similar to the Bircher-type positions, but sometimes for different reasons. For instance, you sided with the white Southerners who didn't want to give blacks the vote, but for a different reason than, say, the Klan did.
Well, most people who defend the Constitution acknowledge that using constitutional mandates, people do good and bad things. The Constitution tells us that we can present pornography without any particular bar. It was nicely put by Irving Kristol when he said you can copulate on the stage in New York provided you paid the minimum wage. Well, that's invoking a constitutional privilege. Now, the constitutional privileges were invoked for 75 years by the South to enforce Jim Crow and for all intents and purposes to prevent the vote under the grandfather clauses in Texas. This was a misuse of the Constitution. There were some people who said, well, let's simply forget the Constitution and correct the abuses. And those were people to whom we said, now, wait a minute. Just as some people say, don't fuss with the First Amendment, even though it gives you pornography, we were able to say, don't fuss with the Constitution, just to create a piece of legislation because you don't like Plessy versus Ferguson. I don't mind saying this now to you, because I've said it before, which is that I'm rather glad we lost that fight. I welcome the results of that disruption, but it was, in my judgment, a constitutional disruption.
Can I read something that you wrote during that period and see?
Write something I wrote in any period.
Okay, here we go. The central question that emerges is whether the white community in the South is entitled to take such measures as are necessary to prevail politically and culturally in areas in which it does not predominate numerically. The sobering answer is yes, the white community is so entitled because for the time being it is the advanced race. The question, as far as the white community is concerned, is whether the claims of civilization supersede those of universal suffrage. National Review believes that the South's premises are correct.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. That is to say, if you believe, as we have traditionally believed up until about 12 years ago, that you shouldn't vote unless you're literate, and if you are prepared to admit that the South was very heavily neglecting the education of black people, then under the circumstances you would have a much higher incidence of white people than of black people voting.
So you
have to remember that we lived then in an age in which people, including myself, contributed to something called the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Well, if you acknowledge that you want to advance colored people, you acknowledge that they weren't at that point as advanced as other people. And under the circumstances, they suffered certain disqualifications, which we all deplore, but which we can't assume were not so.
So you still don't believe in universal suffrage?
I don't believe in universal suffrage if it's defined as anybody who is biologically 18 years old is entitled to vote. Absolutely not. I believe there ought to be certain minimal reservations, which is what was also believed by John Stuart Mill and Thomas Jefferson and George Adams and anybody you can think of.
After trying to create a right that was a more intellectual right, I'm wondering what your impressions were of the new right that came to power with the election of Ronald Reagan, and if you identified with the various groups.
No, that wasn't a new right. Ronald Reagan was an old-fashioned conservative.
Well, I'm not talking about the president himself, but rather some of the groups that supported him.
Well, if you want to get into the taxonomy, I will. There are the so-called new right, then there's the neocons. They're very different. And then there are the traditionalists, and then there are the ecumenists. So did you want to ask me a specific question about the new right?
Yes, well, let's take one of the elements of the new right, say the Christian right, groups like the Moral Majority. I'm wondering if you felt alienated from them and they from you. I think that you, to them, might have represented the hateful establishment. I guess what I'm trying to clarify here is as someone who tried to kind of carve out a new definition of what the right was, when new groups and new points of view were added to the right, whether you felt that the right that you had envisioned was being changed for the better or for the worse.
Well, you would have to be more specific. One of National Review's responsibilities, and one of my responsibilities, to the extent that I'm a figure in it, is to guard against accretions. If some fitful movement or political candidate or whatever thinks that he has the power to attach to the conservative position an obnoxious or eccentric or idiosyncratic position, we're there to say, where do you get off trying to do that? You can't say that it's part of the American tradition to deny, for instance, a black man absolutely equal rights with a white man. So in that sense, we are guardians of a tradition and are highly resentful at any attempt to pass off as conservative a body of thought that isn't in the least that.
Very briefly, in the era of glasnost, are you changing your attitude at all toward the Soviets, or are you suspicious of glasnost?
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay.
I changed my attitude towards who is running Russia at this particular moment. What I am extremely apprehensive about is any notion that this change is something around which we ought to refashion our foreign policy or our defense policy. We're talking about people who dispose of 12,000 nuclear warheads, most of which are aimed at us. And until that threat is eliminated, and until the doctrines of Lenin are renounced, all we have really gotten is a situation in which, recognizing their own reality, is they're letting up a little bit on the oppressions of their own people. But they pose no less of a threat to us now than they did 5 years ago. As a matter of fact, they pose a greater threat because their technology is more refined.
Do you think that being a celebrity has strengthened or weakened your political clout?
I'm not sure it would have any relationship to my political clout. Whatever political clout I have attaches to the plausibility of what I write and what I say in a number of media. If the whole world were converted to my own positions, then I'd have presumably zero clout on the grounds of sheer redundancy.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Nice to talk to you.